Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Monday, the 20th of February, these are our main stories. A war of words between two superpowers. China and the US clash over the suggestion Beijing could send Russia weapons. As France ends military support for Burkina Faso, could Moscow now step in to help the country fight Islamist insurgents? And fears about an invasive mosquito that could have deadly consequences.
It's posing a huge threat in Kenya because Kenya has made a lot of gains in fighting malaria. Malaria is one of the biggest killers in children below five.
Also in this podcast, a special report on the adverts for natural gas that are accused of being misleading. And
the BAFTA goes to...
We have all the latest on who the big winners were at this year's BAFTAs. We will never accept US attempts to dictate our relations with Russia. That pointed statement was delivered by China's top foreign policy official, Wang Yi, on the last day of a global security conference. He was responding to comments by Antony Blinken, his American counterpart, who on Saturday warned the Chinese not to give Russia weapons and ammunition to support its invasion of Ukraine.
We have seen them provide non-lethal support to Russia for use in Ukraine. The concern that we have now is based on information we have that they're considering providing lethal support. And we've made very clear to them that that would cause a serious problem for us and in our relationship.
I asked our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale, what we should make of the Chinese response.
Well, I think this is, you know, a relatively predictable response from the Chinese. If the Americans are accusing them of supporting the Russians with, you know, military hardware and not just, you know, information and diplomatic support, the predictable response is to say, look, we, the Chinese, do not accept, I think, finger-pointing is their phrase, and coercion. I think the really interesting question is whether or not the US attempt to deter China actually bears any fruit.
Why would China... at this stage, want to get involved to that extent in the war, supplying weapons?
That's because the Chinese, by and large, don't do anything without some kind of strategy behind it. Throughout the war, they have largely kept at one remove, neither endorsing nor condemning Russia's invasion, but they have maintained pretty close diplomatic links with Moscow. They've been trading substantially. They've been buying an awful lot of cheap energy from Russia that is currently unable to sell its energy to much of the rest of the world because of Western sanctions. So China has been helping and pretty close to Russia. The question is whether or not China believes that the sheer scale of Western military and political support for Ukraine is such that it needs to tilt the balance in the other way. That might be some of the thinking. It might be that the Chinese believe this is a moment where they can divide the West, because as well as this report from the Americans that they're potentially arming Russia, the Chinese are also preparing to launch some form of peace proposal that we think may be announced in coming days around the anniversary of Russia's invasion. And it could be a moment where China basically tries to harness the views of many countries around the world, particularly in Africa and Asia and Latin America, who do not share the same analysis of the West. They see it as a European war. They don't believe that it has anything to do with fundamental values or the international order as the West does. They just see a war that they feel is illegitimate and is damaging their economies, and they want it over as soon as possible. And the West has woken up to that, and they're beginning to counter that. But I think if China was to put itself at the vanguard of the pro-peace camp around the world, that potentially would put huge pressure on the West in coming months. So that might be part of the calculation as well.
That was James Landale. Burkina Faso has announced the official ending of the French military operation in the country, aimed at defeating and intensifying Islamist insurgency. The move has fueled speculation that Russian mercenaries could fill the void, as they've done in neighbouring Mali. Here's our Africa editor, Mary Harper.
The Burkinabe Chief of General Staff and the head of the French Sabre Force attended what was described as a sombre flag-lowering ceremony in a military barracks. In January, Burkina Faso gave France a month to withdraw its 400 special forces. Their presence has become increasingly unpopular, with crowds waving Russian flags following a coup last year. Burkina Faso denies that Russian mercenaries are already operating on its territory. It's likely it will turn increasingly to Moscow, just as its neighbour Mali has done. French troops were essentially replaced by Russian mercenaries last year. Mali says they're doing a spectacular job. Independent evidence suggests otherwise.
Mary Harper. Scientists in Kenya have detected the presence of a malaria-bearing mosquito that's native to South Asia and resistant to local insecticides. The invasive mosquito has been spreading across the continent and has been found in five other African countries, including Nigeria, in the past decade. Our Africa Health correspondent, Rhoda Odhiambo, has been telling us why health experts in Kenya are worried.
Malaria is one of the biggest killers in children below 5 years because they have very low immunity. So when they get infections such as malaria and they do not get treatment in time, their chances of surviving and even getting to celebrate their fifth birthday becomes lower because of the fact that they do not have a complex immunity. Now, the fact that this type of mosquito has been discovered in Kenya brings another challenge to it because of how it cannot die with the insecticides that are being used not only in Kenya, but across African countries that have high malaria cases. It is believed that it came into Africa through shipping containers from Southeast Asia. It's been detected in several African countries, and many researchers now fear that if many countries are detecting this type of mosquito, then that means that malaria will no longer be seasonal, because in many African countries, malaria cases are mostly high during the rainy seasons. And this particular mosquito, it can survive in both dry and wet areas and can also lay eggs in water containers, especially in urban centers, places that do not have access to tap water.
And what can be done to stop it? Is there anything that can be done?
So one of the ways that they're saying is that countries need to be able to do routine surveillance to know what type of mosquitoes are circulating in their specific countries. Because one thing that we've seen is that the insecticides that are being used were developed so many years ago. So there's need to produce more insecticides that are stronger. But that can only work if countries, again, pull up their socks and start doing routine checkups in places where malaria cases were not reported. And now they're seeing a sporadic increase in cases so that they can be able to know what is driving infections in those particular areas. A lot of research has also shown that a lot of people are now being bitten during the day, because if we look at the traditional approaches that were used in the past and even right now, people are used to sleeping under treated mosquito nets at night. We're used to spraying our homes at night. So do we need to put in those measures during the day so that people protect themselves from malaria, especially children and expectant women?
Rhoda Odhiambo. Like it or not, natural gas is central to many of our lives. We use it to cook, to heat our homes, and to generate electricity. Burning it, however, releases greenhouse gases, which are driving global warming. So why is it that on social media, thousands of adverts are portraying natural gas as a solution to climate change? Well, a BBC investigation has found fossil fuel industry players are spending millions of dollars on social media ads promoting natural gas to the public. But scientists say some of those ads are actually misleading. The BBC's climate disinformation specialist, Marco Silva, has the story.
Every generation cares about the future.
So let's get to work on reaching climate goals.
In the last year, Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, sold more than 12,000 digital ads about natural gas. And among the top 10 ad buyers, 6 had links to the fossil fuel industry. Look through their adverts and you'll see the word clean, referring to natural gas, appears to be everywhere you turn.
Working together, natural gas and renewables are powering a cleaner future.
Cleaner air, more jobs? I mean, that sounds good to me.
Me too.
Because North Carolinians rely on clean natural gas to afford...
But is natural gas as clean as these adverts would suggest? Pep Canadel is the executive director of a research group called Global Carbon Project.
It burns carbon dioxide. It emits carbon dioxide, which is the single most important greenhouse gas leading to climate change.
In some of the ads we've seen, this important context appears to be missing. But in others, the message is slightly different.
America's carbon emissions are at a 27-year low because of the replacement of coal-fired electric power plants with natural gas, which emits half as much carbon dioxide as coal.
Which is why, at least according to these ads, if we're to stand a chance at tackling climate change, we should embrace natural gas. Okay. Naomi Oreskes is a professor of history of science at Harvard University.
The ads we're seeing now are not questioning the fact that climate change is a problem. In fact, the opposite. They're embracing it, and they're claiming that gas is the solution. And it's deeply misleading because gas is not the solution to the climate crisis.
We shared a number of these ads with leading climate scientists from all around the world. And like Ms. Oreskes, they too found some of these ads and their slogans misleading. For its part, Meta says it rejects ads that are false or misleading. But the company didn't take any action on the ones we sent them.
As our children grow, their future depends on the choices you and I make today.
Former U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu co-chairs Natural Allies for a Clean Energy Future, a campaign group backed by the gas industry. Last year, they were one of the top buyers of natural gas ads on Facebook and Instagram. I put the scientist's concerns to her.
It's disappointing because while I think they're very well-intentioned, their job is not to run the economy of the world. It would be wonderful if one of those scientists had a magic wand and tomorrow everyone could be on wind and solar and find some magic portion when the clouds come and when the wind stops.
Looking at some of the adverts, there are a couple of quotes. Clean, affordable, fueling our renewable energy future. I mean, in the context of your adverts, for people who may not necessarily hold all the information, to use repeatedly the words clean is, in their view, misleading.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with the word clean because it is. It's cleaner than coal. It's cleaner than a lot of things that are out there. And it's also an important partner with wind and solar. Natural gas is today and will be for a long time a part of that.
The IPCC, the UN's climate science body, says there are multiple pathways to a climate-friendly future. On one extreme, the IPCC says countries can dramatically cut down on all fossil fuel, oil, coal, gas, and instead rely on other sources of energy, be it renewables or nuclear. Alternatively, we can rely to some extent on natural gas and combine that with extensive carbon capture, which for the moment still costs a lot of money.
Marco Silva. Next, some of the biggest names in Hollywood have been in London for the BAFTAs, the UK's most prestigious film awards.
And the BAFTA goes to All Quiet on the Western Front.
Wow. German language film. We've been blessed with so many nominations. And winning this is just incredible.
All Quiet on the Western Front got the most prizes overall, including Best Director. Our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson, was at the BAFTAs, so was he surprised?
If I'm honest, I was predicting The Banshees of Inisherin, the film about feuding friends in Ireland, would do the double and win Best Film and Best British Film. Now, it won Best British Film. It won in both supporting acting categories, with Kerry Condon winning for Supporting Actress and Barry Keoghan winning Best Supporting Actor. But throughout the night, All Quiet on the Western Front, this adaptation of the 1928 anti-war novel by Erich Maria Remarque, a German novel, it just got momentum. It kept winning awards. It was winning cinematography. It was winning score. And when it won Best Director, you could hear people in the press room going, I think it might do it. And it did. And there you had, that was the producer you heard, Malte Grunert, speaking and just saying how important a film it is and how what it talks about and right-wing power being used to drive people to war was still a very prescient topic today. Also worth saying, the film would not have been made if it was not for two Brits. A Scottish triathlete, Leslie Patterson, who used winnings from winning triathlons to retain the book rights and get it made. And Ian Stokel, a man who once made his money by writing a very successful coaching manual about women's soccer. So that's a very diverse bunch that got this film made, yeah.
Obviously. obviously this was made by Netflix. Do some of the more traditional Hollywood studios feel a bit resentful that Netflix is making such strides and they're taking home these big awards for their films?
The big studios are worried. Last year, for the first time, we had a streamer winning Best Picture at the Oscars. That was Coda. We've had a streamer winner before here because we had Roma a few years ago, won at the BAFTAs. But again, a streamer, a Netflix film, has won, taking the power away from the studios. But we did still get some studios winning big tonight. Elvis won 3 awards, including leading actor for Austin Butler. He dedicated that to the whole Presley family. And then Tar, leading actress, went to Cate Blanchett, her 3rd BAFTA, for winning, for playing this conductor accused of abuse. That's her 3rd BAFTA win, and she puts a 1 behind the all-time record held by Dame Maggie Smith.
That was Colin Patterson at the BAFTAs. Some breaking news to bring you. Japan and South Korea say North Korea has fired a ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan. The report comes hours after the US and South Korea held a joint military drill in response to a similar missile launch on Saturday. North Korea said the test was designed to show it was able to fire nuclear-capable missiles at such short notice in response to any threats. It's trying to deter the US and Seoul from holding annual military exercises next month. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
I love Xiangxiang so much. I've made Xiangxiang teddies, shoes. Maybe I will start to feel the loss when I see her later today.
People in Japan say goodbye to some VIPs. Thousands of demonstrators have taken part in a rally in the capital of Moldova to protest about the pro-Western government and high fuel prices triggered by the war in Ukraine. The protest was organised by the pro-Russian opposition party SOAR. Only days earlier, President Sandu had warned of a Russian plot to infiltrate and destabilise the country. Our correspondent Lucy Williamson was at the protest in the capital Chisinau and sent us this report.
Protesters here all have the same story to tell. Energy prices are eating up half their pension or eating into the family food budget. The pro-Russian opposition is demanding the government pay people's energy bills, which have spiralled to more than 70% of household income. Russia cut gas supplies to Moldova last year, but protesters here don't blame Moscow for the price hikes. They blame their own government for alienating Russia with its pro-Western policies. Earlier this week, Moldova's president, Maia Sandu, said she'd seen intelligence suggesting that Russia was planning to send military-trained saboteurs into the country, disguised as civilians, to topple her pro-Western government. I asked one group of protesters whether they think Russia does want to infiltrate their country. Yes, let them come, they shout. We want them to come here. We want to be part of Russia. The war next door in Ukraine has increased the pressures on Moldova. Its population split between Romanian and Russian speakers, between those who support closer ties with the EU and those who want good relations with Moscow.
Lucy Williamson. The disappearance of Nicola Bulley, a 45-year-old woman who went missing while walking her dog near a river in a village in northern England more than 3 weeks ago, has dominated headlines across Britain. There's been widespread speculation online about what happened to her, with amateur detectives even turning up in the village to carry out their own investigations. The police, who were heavily criticised after revealing personal medical details about Ms. Bulley, now say they found a body in the river, although formal identification hasn't been carried out yet. I asked our Home Affairs correspondent, Mark Easton, why this case had attracted so much attention.
Sometimes a story will win over sort of public concern, huge amount of interest anyway, here at the BBC. You know, our viewers and listeners were desperate to learn more about the Nicola Bulley disappearance. Maybe huge numbers of people kind of recognised themselves in her and were puzzled by what might have happened. But yes, if this body does indeed prove to be her, and if, as the police have always said, it was a tragic accident, it's a story that, if it had been resolved quickly, probably would have made no more than the local paper.
And do you think things will change from this with the police and also with social media, these amateur detectives that were showing up in this small village, some even digging in fields?
In England and Wales, there are 43 police forces, some of them very small. Lancashire is about a tenth of the size of the Met in London. So it's a small force. And then suddenly they have the world's media descending on them and world interest as well. And I think that there will be questions around the way that small forces like that handle that kind of spotlight, that kind of attention. Certainly, I think in terms of the TikTok detectives going and trying to win themselves clicks and followers by coming up with some theory around a story which had obviously, as I say, won a lot of public interest. And I think the other thing actually is about the police itself and the way in which the investigation, which became a matter of huge concern for the top of government in the UK, with both the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary expressing concern because the police revealed personal details about Nicola Bulley, her struggles with alcohol and with the menopause. So I think there are lots of questions still to be answered, actually. Even if this case is drawing to a tragic close, I think there are some really big questions for Lancashire Police about how they handled themselves. It may be that there was a body less than a mile from where Nicola Bulley disappeared in the river for 3 weeks. And I think we've seen in this case that perhaps a more experienced force dealing with that level of public interest might have coped better.
That was Mark Easton. Last week, a court in Nicaragua stripped 94 exiled opponents of President Daniel Ortega of their citizenship, charging them with treason. The left-wing leader overthrew a dictatorship in the 1979 Sandinista Revolution, but now stands accused by opponents of exhibiting similar autocratic tendencies. The writer, Gioconda Belli, was a Sandinista revolutionary alongside Daniel Ortega, but has also been stripped of her citizenship. From Madrid, she gave James Kumarasamy her reaction to the ruling.
I never thought they could strip me of my Nicaraguan citizenship. So that part was like an absurd idea of this government of Daniel Ortega. I know that it's totally unconstitutional and totally against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I was shocked to see my son was in the list. I was shocked to know that they were going to take over all my properties and my house. I had no idea they could go that far to harm the people who have not done anything bad. I haven't done anything that could be called betrayal to my homeland. I mean, all those accusations are such a lie, a fabrication of to get rid of all the opposition that they have in the country, and also to inspire terror in people when they start threatening you with taking away your nationality and taking away all your belongings. People are going to be very afraid.
Is there anything you can do about this? Do you have any recourse?
It's a lawless country. They are the arbiters of everything. Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo. The judicial system is non-existent. They do whatever they want with the laws. They change the law whenever they want. They change the constitution whenever they want. And anything that is convenient for their purposes, they do.
What would you like to see happen to try and reverse the current way Nicaragua is going?
Well, international community has to be more forceful and do not allow these kinds of violations of human rights and this kind of trampling on all the principles and treaties that rule the coexistence of nations in the world. I would like to see more actions on the part of the Latin American governments. All the pronouncements of these governments have been very mild. I think Lula hasn't said a word. Mexico hasn't said a word. So it's very sad to see this complicity on the part of the Latin American governments.
As a writer, can you in any way look at this as a tragic story arc for your country and see Ortega as a sort of character in something?
Yes, my country is like Sisyphus' country. You know, we have tried so many times to take the boulder up the mountain and then it keeps coming down the mountain. There is something to be said about taking the boulder up the mountain as a heroic task, and something that we should not rebel against, but as a rebellion, pushing the boulder up the mountain. I think an alternative would fire up the desire of people to be free and would overcome the fear that they have.
Would you like to be part of that?
Yes, I would.
At the moment, you can't go back to Nicaragua, though, can you? Are you confident a time will come when you will be allowed back?
Yes, I am. Dictatorships don't last forever.
Gioconda Belli speaking to James Kumarasamy. Some very important pandas are returning to China from Japan later this week. Thousands of fans have been saying their goodbyes to the animals, as Andrew Ochieng reports.
There were long queues at Tokyo's Ueno Zoo as visitors lined up to catch a final glimpse of Xiangxiang, who has been a massive draw for the park since her birth in 2017. It may have been the hottest ticket in town. The last viewing was limited to some 2,000 visitors who won their places in a lottery. Xiangxiang was supposed to leave when she was two, but her journey was delayed by COVID. Now the time has come. One fan outside the zoo, whose clothes were plastered with panda pictures, was all emotions.
I love Xiangxiang so much. These are all pictures of Xiangxiang. I've made Xiangxiang teddies, shoes, all sorts with the pictures I've taken. It doesn't feel real yet, but I have one of the last time slots to see her. Maybe I will start to feel the loss when I see her later today.
She was the first panda born in the zoo since 1988. The black and white mammals are popular around the world, and China loans them out as part of a so-called panda diplomacy program to foster foreign ties. Many, though, don't want to see them go.
I wish pandas could stay in Japan for longer, so children could come and see them more often. But if this is the agreement, we have to accept it. It's a pity.
Another panda heading to China is Ai Mei, who in 2020 became the world's oldest father to a baby. He was 28, thus the panda equivalent of a human in his 80s.
Andrew Ochieng. Finally, a New York-based photographer has been giving lots of people joy. Not with pictures he's taken himself, although he does do that. He has a passion for finding old photos, perhaps in secondhand shops, and then finding a way of returning them to the people they originally belonged to. David Guttermacher told Paul Henley how he started reuniting people with their long-lost photos.
I always went to thrift stores looking for old cameras and other just vintage items like that. And one day I came across a bin full of old photographs, and they were just sitting in the back of the store collecting dust. And I thought that if my family photos or my photos that were so important to me ended up in the store, that someone would turn over the back, see someone's name on it, and if they found my last name, they'd look me up and return it to me. So I thought I might as well be doing that for other people. Ones from the 90s and 2000s have a special place in my heart just because they're closer to my childhood. But I also love photographs from the 40s or the 50s. There's like a real humanity in those photographs, I find, for some reason.
How do you get them back to their rightful owners? How do you find them?
Depending on what I buy, whether it's photographs or home movies, I will digitize them and post them to social media. And then my followers will do all of the research to try to get any information on the owners as possible. And they'll send it over to me. I'll update my followers on Instagram stories. And eventually we find the family.
What sort of reactions have you had?
People have definitely been shocked and confused about how their photos ended up on social media, but everyone's been extremely grateful to get their memories back.
You'd have thought that if these things were in thrift stores or junk shops, people wouldn't necessarily want them back. Some people are quite keen to forget family members and their own old lives.
Yeah, so I often get comments of people joking, saying, if my photos ever end up in a store, just keep them. But I think that most of the time these photographs end up there because someone put them in the wrong box, either during a move or after a family member passed away and they were cleaning out the home. I think most people who don't want their memories throw it away in the garbage. But so far, everyone that I've spoken to has pretty much lost their memories in a move. And when they heard that they had something out there, they were ecstatic to find out that it wasn't gone.
Do you think printed photos have the same meaning for us now that nearly all of us have a smartphone?
Specifically, printed photos, I think, do still have that meaning. I think that photos in general don't, because what it took to have a single photograph in 1940 is so different from what it takes to have 1,000 photographs now. But I think that people still are not printing their photographs as often as they might have been throughout history. So I think that printed photographs, they might be valued less, but we should be printing our photographs way more.
Is there a story that you can think of about a photo being reunited with its owner? I'm nosy, and it sounds like you are too.
One of my favorite finds was a roll of film from 1943 that was inside of a canister. And there was a note inside that said, these photos were taken in April 1943, and the note was written in German. And on the back of the note was the name Friedman. And I posted that to social media, and immediately people were obsessed with the photographs and started digging into every detail of the photos to try to get whatever clues we could. They identified the lampposts and the city streets and identified that the photos were taken in Detroit and in New York. And after about a week of searching, we identified the family, a Friedman family, who since then, everyone in the photograph has passed away. And 3 days before we were able to find the family, the last survivor who was in those photos had passed away. So the timing was just incredible. And it was such a beautiful story of how that family escaped Germany in the late 1930s and ended up in America. And to be able to return those photos back to that family who hadn't seen them before was just extremely special.
David Guttenmacher, a photographer in New York City, speaking to Paul Henley about his passion for reuniting people with their lost photos. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Ethan Connolly Forster, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.
On the podcast Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Celebrating 13 awards, including Best Creativity Podcast, you'll learn from iconic creatives like Pixar director Domi Shih.
Go big, shoot for the sun, and then you can like land on the moon.
Actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I had to take responsibility for my own creativity.
And best-selling author Ann Patchett.
If you want to be better, you just have to keep doing it.
Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.